Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. On today's show, is Albuquerque in the midst of an epic crime wave, and are more police the answer? We'll ask two national experts, UNM sociology professors Maria Velas and Christopher Lyons. Maria Velas and Christopher Lyons, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
Maria, if I could start with you, before we get to your take on crime in Albuquerque, I'd like to just get a sense of what you, as a sociologist, look at when you study crime. What are the kinds of things you focus on?
Yeah, a great question. My area of interest are particularly about how the neighborhood is doing in terms of socioeconomic conditions. So things like poverty, their levels of educational attainment. And then I'm interested in how a neighborhood fares in terms of crime and how it's influenced by the political economy. So things like, where is that neighborhood situated in the city? Is it in a place, is it surrounded by other places that are poor, or is it near other neighborhoods that are wealthy? And so sort of thinking about the fate of a neighborhood and how it's connected to these broader socioeconomic and political dynamics.
And Christopher, if I could bring you into the discussion, mm-hmm. when I was looking to do this show at first, I couldn't help but notice that you and Maria had collaborated on a number of different papers. And I wonder if you could just give us an idea of the kinds of collaboration you guys have done.
Yeah, we consider ourselves partners in crime. No pun intended. We've been collaborating a lot. You know, I think when we first became colleagues at UNM, we found that we had a lot of similar perspectives. Particularly, we tend to focus on the types of places versus the types of people. And research that Maria and theory that Maria's already
discussed. These neighborhoods that Maria was talking about.
Yeah, so neighborhoods, but also cities, but also states. It's more about the structure and the conditions of those places than the types of people who live in them. In fact, conditions such as socioeconomic conditions like poverty, unemployment, vacant housings, quality of schools, housing prices, and so forth, tend to influence crime regardless of who lives in the neighborhood. So that over time, you find that some people, the neighborhoods change pretty dramatically in the type and the residents who live there, whether it's the racial or ethnic kind of composition of the neighborhoods. Yet the crime rates tend to stay the same because these socioeconomic conditions stay the same.
I see. That's fascinating.
Yeah. And so that's a broader perspective. And so we've been, in our work, have tried to query what are the processes by which these things happen. And so we have a number of projects underway. We also are very interested in how neighborhood viability is shaped by the broader political and economic climate of cities, for example. Cities and city actors shape neighborhoods in very important ways. We call that sort of the making or breaking of neighborhoods via certain policies, investment strategies, and so forth.
Fascinating. But I'm going to get right down to my issue, which is, maybe I'll come back to you, Maria, and ask you, is Albuquerque suffering an epic crime wave? Because if you watch television or read the newspapers, that's certainly the impression you'd have. And if you watch the mayoral election or watch the recent legislative session, that's also the impression you'd have. So how would you approach and answer that question?
Well, I think the first thing would be to look at what the crime data tell us. And
okay.
So we have the primary source of crime data that is available here in Albuquerque, and Christopher and I have spent a lot of time discussing this, is what we would call official crime data, which is data that are being collected by the police. And if you look at homicide, which is our most reliable source of crime data, you can see that it has fluctuated in terms of its level from 1985 to 2016. So the idea that my first reaction is that we are experiencing a crime increase in the last couple of years, potentially. But I wouldn't call it epic, and I wouldn't call it a wave necessarily. And that we've had higher levels of homicide, murder, earlier in our period that you could look at. So, for instance, in the 80s, it was higher, and also in the early 1990s, homicide was pretty high, as well as in the around the 2000. It's fluctuated a little bit in the 2009 period, and so what we, Christopher and I, would really want to think about is that when we look at the crime data, and we can talk more specifically about other types of crime, is it, the neighborhoods and communities seem safer today than they were 20, 25 years ago.
Well, one of the things that struck me when I looked at the data was that a lot of discussion is about the increase in violent crime.
Mm-hmm.
But the increase is starting from a very low point. That it seems like homicides and had fallen to a very low point before the increase. So almost necessarily, Christopher, you would think there'd be an increase.
That is interesting. It's like we could call that a floor versus ceiling effect. When you hit really low, you kind of will see some increases over time. So in 2014, we hit a pretty low murder rate, which is great, around 5.4 per
100,000.
And so we've gone up significantly since then. So,
yeah, 100%, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've doubled that in at least in over...
And that's what's scaring people, right?
That's what's scaring people. Well, you know, it's hard to know whether the political debate is actually tethered to the actual data. I mean...
That's true.
It is much broader than that. But certainly, since 2014, we've seen increases in most of our major indicators of crime, both, and you know, including property crime as well. And particularly since 2015 and then 16 really seems to be pretty large. And we don't have recent data on 2017, but it seems to be following that trend, at least from what we've been able to see. But it is important to look at a much broader trend. Over the last 30 years, we can say that we experienced a pretty dramatic decrease in the 90s in crime. It peaked in the mid-90s. It's gone down pretty dramatically since then. And it's only recently, though, that we're starting to see a change. Now, is that a reversal of what's been called the great crime decline? It's too early to say, right? It's hard to make too much out of like a 3-year crime increase. So I would be cautious to say that we're in the midst of an epidemic, but it is a cause for concern. And so we do need to look at these.
I mean, it's back up to where it used to be, but sort of below the mean in terms of violent crime, right, Maria?
Yes, and I was just going to follow up that
yeah.
that in terms of the context, Christopher mentioned this idea of the Great American Crime Decline, which scholars have been trying to figure out what is responsible for that.
Yeah, what I'd love to ask that question.
Well, there's some major hypotheses out there, but we know that the crime decline at the beginning may have been contributed to by some levels of incarceration. We've had increases in incarceration. There has been some role of policing, but there's also things like immigration, lower levels of poverty. Some people have found that to be the case. So there's a lot of different contenders, but there's no cohesive explanation as of now what specifically has led to the crime drop. So,
okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I would like to talk to you about property crime, which has also been increasing.
This Week in This American Life. 5 women.
I'm 8, and I felt like I was going to die if I never met him.
They had, like, named someone, like, the hypnotizer. They're like, oh, the hypnotizer. But eventually I found out it was me.
Like, I'm 12, and you're an adult, talking about, like, my body and, like, boys, and it's so uncomfortable. Like,
we are the personal histories of 5 women, and how those histories affected them when they all came into contact with the same man.
Sundays at 4 on KUNM.
We are back on New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have in the studio Maria Velas and Christopher Lyons. And Christopher, we were just talking about the violent crime rate. And just what's your take? I mean, is it more, should we be focused more on the increase or more on sort of returning to the mean, or how would you just evaluate it? The violent crime rate.
Well, I think there's a couple things to keep in mind. One is that Albuquerque's crime rate, violent crime rate, and poverty crime rate is higher than a lot of other cities. It's not the highest by any means, but it's in the upper part of, you know, of large cities. It has a higher crime rate.
And has that been consistently true historically?
That's been pretty consistent over
time.
Yeah,
I see.
And then the second question is, how has Albuquerque's crime rate changed?
Yes.
Right? So two cities can change, but one can still have a much higher level than the other. So they're kind of separate questions. One is sort of a between neighborhood explanation. The other one is within the neighborhood or cities, how much change and how rapidly the change is. So it's clear that Albuquerque has had higher property and higher violent crime rate than many other cities, but certainly much lower than cities like Chicago when you compare homicide. We tend to have, though, a little higher when it comes to burglary, larceny, and motor vehicle theft. I know there's been a lot of discussion.
Those are property crimes.
Those are property crimes, and there's been a lot of discussion recently, some people arguing that we're the worst city or state for motor vehicle crimes or theft. And I can't really verify that, compare it. I don't have the data in front of me, but I know that we have a high rate for certainly.
I mean, there's no doubt, Maria, that property crimes have dramatically increased since 2010, right? And this is something that, when I looked at it anyway, seemed to be inconsistent with the general crime trend and inconsistent with what similar cities were doing, that it seemed like we were somewhat of an outlier when it came to increases in property crime.
In terms of the outlier compared to others,
the rate of property crime and the rate of increase in property crime.
I'm not sure if I would call it an outlier in terms of how it might compare to other places, because we know that other cities have experienced increases in property crime as well. In terms of Albuquerque specifically, when I look at the data for property crime, I see that it has been going up since about 2010. But when you look at, let's say, burglary, it's not as dramatic the increases as it might be for another type of crime like larceny theft, right? So so I'm not sure exactly how much more I would say about that.
So but if you look from 10,000 feet, then if we look at the increase in the crime rate. I mean, what conclusions? I mean, has it just been exaggerated? I mean, we're not on the edge of civilization here, right? It's not the Wild West, as some people are
saying.
So
if I'm at Sandia Crest looking down 10,000 feet, I would say it's both been exaggerated and it has a kernel truth to it.
Okay.
We have, and which is very common, by the way, certainly property crime has gone up and down. We do seem to be, both with property crime and violent crime, in the midst of a short-term, what hopefully will be a short-term, but it's certainly a recent increase since 2014-15. And it's a cause for concern. The question, though, is, is it going to continue and so forth? We've seen in the history over the last 30 years, other three-year increases followed by a pretty dramatic decrease in the fourth year. So we don't quite have a good handle on it. Criminologists generally are much better at understanding longer-term crime trends versus the short-term crime trends, because short-term crime trends could be so many different things. Could be even different.
Yeah, I noticed when I looked, it goes up and down when three-year periods all over the place. Exactly. There's a lot of variation.
Yeah.
And we and sort of the news media tend to focus on what's happening right now as opposed to looking at the historical trend. And that's what you're saying, like, we should be focusing more on the historical trend.
Yeah, and we should be focusing on the historical trend, but we also want to keep our eyes peel to what's going on right now too, because I think there are some things.
Absolutely.
And if the data were actually better, we should have 2017 data, but we don't have those yet. Those are not available from what we call the Uniform Crime Report, and that's a national problem. But ideally we would be able to have fine-grained data there.
So one sort of final question on this related topic, Maria. All this crime data seems to leave out white-collar crime. And white-collar crime, like, if you talk about the Great Recession, so much of the Great Recession supposedly was the fault of criminals influencing people to take out mortgage loans they couldn't afford. And arguably that has a much bigger effect on a neighborhood, for example, than somebody stealing your purse or wallet. Yet that isn't even considered when we look at this data.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the major criticisms of crime reporting statistics in general. Yeah, that, and we spend a fair amount of time in our undergraduate courses getting into that. And your example about the criminals, quote unquote, in the recession, I mean, one of the bigger issues that we could probably have a whole other episode about is they're not really considered criminals, right? In terms of the way we track criminal behavior, we're very, very focused on what we would consider street crime, which are these seven indicators mostly that we've been discussing here today that are tracked by the Uniform Crime Report. But there are other sources of crime data that would be better able to document some of these other patterns, but they're not used in a way that are meaningful potentially for neighborhoods of crime. And can I just say one thing about from the Sandia Crest idea?
Yeah, right.
And is that
10,000 feet.
10,000 feet. One thing I think Christopher and I would want people to think about also is that when you're that usually crime and where it's high or low is going to differentially impact the level of crime at the city level. So if I know that crime is going up since 14, any type of crime, I would want to know where is the crime happening and what is going on in those communities.
So I'd like to come back to that in a second, but first I'd like to just address the depolicing argument. And I'm sure you're familiar with it, but, you know, throughout the mayoral election campaign, there was this talk that we're 400 officers short. There's this idea that maybe after the James Boyd shooting, that there was more, you know, the police were reluctant to enforce the law. And then we had the DOJ settlement agreement. Again, we have a lot of focus on the police. So the question is, how much do you think, Christopher, we should look at depolicing as a possible answer, particularly for the property crime, which has gone up? Do you want to take a shot at that?
Research shows that police per capita increasing police per capita can actually help decrease crime. But the bigger question, though, is how police are deployed. So just hiring more police in the ranks or giving them better pay isn't necessarily the answer. It's how are they deployed. For example, are they deployed toward more proactive policing strategies like community policings, which helps break down, at least theoretically, the barrier between
policing. Without community policing, is just reactive, right? You're actually not doing anything to stop the crime.
Right. What 90 to 95% of all of our data or information on crime comes from reports to the police. Proactive policing is actually working with communities to break down the barriers between the policing and the communities empower communities, to help, you know, not only train communities how to take better care of their neighborhoods, but also break down the barriers so that communities actually trust the police, call on the police, instead of having to deal with problems on their own, if they deal with them at all. If some research has shown that when police are hired under that kind of cultural change of community policing, it can actually be quite beneficial. You need a lot of people on the streets to do that kind of work. If you're just hiring police in a culture that is already just very reactive, it may not work at all. In fact, it could actually backfire. We could actually have more, tough policing kind of policies, which can reduce the legitimacy of the police and trust in the police and so forth. So it's not only that, you know, the DOJ may have a chilling effect on police and then they may be afraid to do their work. What we actually find that may be more important is that there's a reduction in trust in the police. And so the communities don't trust the police. They don't want to interact with the police. They don't want to, they may try to solve problems in their own way, and that can create problems in higher crime rates as well.
If you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased that I have UNM professors Maria Velas and Christopher Lyons. They are sociologists, and we're talking about crime in Albuquerque. And Maria, when I tried to look at and see whether depolicing had occurred, particularly with violent crime, it looked to me like the number of bookings into the MDC had been fairly steady, and there didn't seem to be any indication. And actually, the conviction rate went up. The convictions into prison for felonies went up with the crime rate. But I saw a different picture when I looked at property crime. When you look at bookings, misdemeanor bookings, they went sharply down while property crime was going up. So is there a depolicing argument there?
Well, I think that depolicing, the idea that policing is important in the question about crime and crime control, I think is an important one. So whether or not it's specifically police withdrawing from withdrawing from the community and engaging in crime control is an important question. I don't know why there would be depolicing for one type of crime and not for the other. I think what Christopher and I would say is that the idea that police are withdrawing from the community, right, withdrawing from doing their work,
yes,
and that's why crime is going up, it's an empirical question. It hasn't borne fruit in other areas. So people have studied, the corollary argument is the Ferguson effect. And in New York City, there were police officers claiming that they also were not engaging in police work either, because there was some stuff happening in after the Eric Garner case, right? And the research that there's not a lot of it, suggests that crime was already going up, let's say for the Ferguson, St. Louis area, crime was already going up before those events happened.
And that's true of the James Boyd, using the James Boyd example.
Exactly.
Crime was already going up, property crime and violent crime were already going up.
Yeah, so it's an empirical question. I don't know if we can really say definitively. I think what police do, what the research suggests is that what police do can play a role in crime patterns, and it can play a small role in helping explain the crime drop. But there are much bigger other factors that also play a role.
So let's talk about the other factors that you think are significant aside from depolicing.
Well, just to make that transition, depolicing and underfunding the DA's office and so forth is probably a part of a broader process where we've underfunded our institutions in the state and in the city. We're starting to sort of backfill those with the recent cash that we might have a little bit recently.
Right. We've had a downturn. The whole economy's down, and the state revenues are down, and city revenues are down.
Yeah, especially compared to the beginning of the economic recession in 2007, really. Or 8 and 9, and so I think one of the leading hypotheses for why there could be a change is the economic conditions and the economic sort of recession that we've experienced. These don't necessarily map contemporaneously. That is, you can be in a height of recession and crime may not change, but it can change over time. So you could have what we call a lagged effect. And the fact that New Mexico and Albuquerque as well has taken so long to emerge from the current recession.
I mean, arguably, it hasn't really emerged.
It hasn't emerged. I mean,
right.
we still
have the second highest unemployment rate in the country.
Exactly. We have the second highest unemployment rate in the country, the state. The state that has the highest unemployment rate also has very high crime rates, and that's Alaska. And that's not, you know, that's not random. There's a reason for that. And it's the fact, it's also being the idea of being left behind. You know, this is a lost decade in the state in terms of economic growth, and inflation has begun to creep up, and wages have not kept up with inflation. So not only are we seeing that we were kind of, in many neighborhoods within Albuquerque were poor to begin with and had fewer resources to begin with, but they haven't improved, they've gotten worse, in a time when our neighbors have actually seen the improvement.
Okay, so what I don't get, and I'm sure listeners want to know, is how does that connect to crime? Okay, so we have, you know, maybe Albuquerque's been growing at 1%, almost maybe it's population growth, so almost nothing. So there's been no growth, and maybe these neighborhoods were bad to begin with, but, you know, in the ways that you described, there was high levels of unemployment, high vacancy rates in buildings, etc. But what does that have to do with crime?
I would say that we would point to two possibilities. One is that what is happening at the local level in Albuquerque. So let's say our unemployment rates have gone up significantly in the last 10 to 15 years, for instance. And so then neighborhoods that are already vulnerable to crime are going to be made particularly vulnerable to crime, and we'll talk about the mechanisms here in a minute, because they're in a city that is already very poor, right? So there is this interaction between the city's economic conditions and then also what's going on at the neighborhood level. So that's one way that cities, where these things are happening, is important to consider. Is the city, how's the city itself doing? And then how are neighborhoods doing within that city?
So we have this area called the war zone.
Mm-hmm.
So how, maybe you could explain, like, how would the downturn in the economy affect that area?
Because, well, first of all, because it's in the neighborhood that is the International District, a.k.a. the war zone.
Yes.
It is in a city that is already very poor. So we would want to know that a similar neighborhood that had the same socioeconomic characteristics of the International District in Seattle may look very different, right? And then you add on the fact that in that neighborhood, there's been an increase in housing instability, unemployment, dearth of professional role models, et cetera. These are supposed to lead to something called social disorganization, which was the idea that communities are unable to address the problems related to crime in the community. They're not able to organize effectively as in other neighborhoods.
So resource-poor neighborhoods are less able to use their resources to control crime. Let's just use foreclosures, for example. The International District was pretty hard hit by foreclosure. So then you end up having more vacant housing. Vacant housing in turn can lead to crime. In a lot of vacant housing particularly can be burglarized, even though there's not much in there, but people can hang out there and there can be drug use and so forth. We're worried about how vacant housing can sort of house criminal activities, encourage that. Being part of a neighborhood where you see a lot of vacant lots and a lot of disused,
boarded up buildings, motels that are closed up,
as well as, you know, green spaces that are, well, not very green in Albuquerque, but they're often trashed and so forth. It also sends
scary. They're almost scary.
It sends the message that, you know, along with broken windows kind of idea, that maybe this community is not able to really do much about it. That could actually encourage criminal behavior, and and then there's the corollary kind of concern that the communities aren't able to come together to do too much about it. So that's just one example with foreclosures.
So we're nearing the end of the show, and you've probably heard that there's a proposal that about $55 million would be raised as a public, what they're calling a public safety tax, Maria. How would you argue that some portion of that $55 million should be invested in these disadvantaged communities that you've been describing, and purely from a public safety point of view?
I think the way to think about using those resources would to be able to bolster the activities that are happening in the community that help bring about the spirit of community social organization. So having neighborhoods and neighbors invest in their community, watch out for public spaces, green up areas, use public spaces so that they can be used by the children in the neighborhood. I think my model is an example is having an office of neighborhoods where this is true in Seattle, for instance, where they provide resources for communities to improve their green spaces, neighborhood recreation centers, etc.
We're going to have to end it there. I would like to thank Professors Maria Velas and Christopher Lyons for taking the time to speak with us. Thanks also to my engineer, Marshall Broyles. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Shebeki. You've been listening to New Mexico People, Places and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are available at iTunes. Search Stephen Spitz. Archives of my past shows are at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.